Reed, Frankfurt, and Coke when the question of the nature of the implementing order was discussed at conference. This was in 1955.
The various members of the court were united in trying to get a unanimous opinion and a unanimous vote behind a decree. The problem was discussed at some length. Some thought that these suits were real class suits and the decree should be broadly written. Others thought that relief should be restricted to the named plaintiffs. The three justices you mentioned, Reed, Frankfurter, and Clark, were in most respects close to the consensus of the conference. If that is he never had any regard for Vincent, and he thought that Vincent, which is probably true, would have voted the other way. But Frankfurter, in the earlier conferences concerning the segregation problem, seemed to be filling the role not of a statesman so much as a man who was frightened and timid and reluctant to walk up to an issue that would displace the ancient institution of segregation in the South. But it was interesting that at this conference on 16th of April 1955, he explained to the conference about he was willing to make the decision all along. He was just playing the role of a statesman who thought filibustering was in the public interest under Vincent. I don't think that that was really the truth of the matter. I don't think that Frankfurter was intellectually honest in taking that position. I think it was a position, as the records in the previous cases show, of a man who was very frightened, very uncertain, very unsure, very hesitant to walk up to the major issue of the racial problem of our time. But His emphasis in this conference on April 16, 1955, as I recall it, was for a slow speed, not haste, for accommodation, for a decree that wouldn't jolt or excite or disturb anyone in the South. His position was that the force of the Brown decision was largely educational and that not much could be accomplished through the writing of decrees. But I don't think he represented the consensus. He went along in the decree that was later written. I think that the consensus was that a decree that was firm and unequivocal was a very important factor in getting the changes in the institutional scheme that had been embedded in the South. And that while it couldn't be done overnight, that the ancient chancery phrase, with all deliberate speed, was the appropriate one for this occasion.
I was wondering, do you remember also offhand what position perhaps Justice Black took on this? Was he one of those who thought of this as a genuine class action and wanted more definitive decree?
Black thought that there should be unanimous action, and he was willing to go along with almost anything that would produce unanimity. To the lower courts. He thought that we should not write any additional opinion, but just enter a decree. He didn't think that there would be any federal judge in the South who would go along and back up a vigorous decree. History proved Hugo Black to be wrong on that. But one of the greatest demonstrations of adherence to the law has been made in the South by Southern federal judges who, by and large, have hewed right to the line and enforced the law with vigor and fairness. He, in the main, was inclined to restrict the relief only to the named plaintiffs and not to extend it to the whole class. His main difference from the conference was to have no opinions, but just a decree, and to have a short decree, leaving it the matter largely in the discretion of the district judges, federal district judges, in these various areas.
What do you recall what position you took on this?
My position was that we should have an opinion, that we should have a decree, that the decree should be limited to the named plaintiffs, that the decree should require prompt compliance with our decision. I think by the end of the discussion, the consensus was that the phrase "all deliberate speed" was the appropriate one to use, and that was the one that was used.
Do you remember offhand, by the way, who suggested that particular chancery phrase? It's one I know that Frankfurter has used in a number of, or had used in a number of opinions previously. It was one that Holmes used to like.
I don't know. Of course, it came into the argument. I believe in the conference discussion that it was Reed who made the point explicit. I think his words in the conference were "with all convenience speed." I think that was the phrase that he used. I think he was the first in the conference discussion to phrase it in that way, although from the very beginning of the discussion, by Earl Warren, he had stated that he did not think that any particular date should be put on a decree, compliance by a certain date or else. He did not go for that, and I don't think anybody in the conference did.
This is interesting in the sense that if the conference was on 16 April and the opinion coming down May 31st, it must have meant that there was, when you left the conference, very considerable consensus then.
Yes, a consensus on most of it, with all convenience speed or all deliberate speed. Most of them were favoring an opinion.
Well, this was a backtracking on my own questions of last time. If we could move on to the questions for this time. I noticed in going through the Franklin D. Roosevelt papers that there was a memorandum of 2 June 1942 from Marvin McIntyre, the President's Secretary, to FDR, which said, quote, "Bill Douglas called me this afternoon and said he was ready to report. Said that he had talked the matter over with Black and Roberts and both questioned the wisdom. He said you would understand," and so on, end quote. I know a number of historians are going to wonder what this memorandum and your call were about. Do you, going back over 20 years, does this ring any bell with you?
haven't any record in my office that I've been able to find concerning this conversation. My recollection is that it related to a proposition that Roosevelt had made to me. I had come on the court in 1939. At that time, I was very close to Roosevelt. And between 1939 and 1942, I saw a lot of him. Almost every year, he had proposed to me that I do certain things for him in the summer, that I stay on in Washington, that I be an administrative assistant at the White House. In 1942, he had some similar idea. Now, what the precise job was, I don't know, but it had something to do with an office in the White House, with me supervising some activities in connection with the war effort. And I had always told him I didn't think that the member of the court should do that, that if he had a real job, he should, the judge should resign and undertake it if he wanted to do it. I remember talking to Black and to Roberts about it, and both of them were pretty clear. They agreed with me, and I believe that's what that conversation was about.
Right, as you know, that was Stone's feeling on the matter in general. He had several such proposals made to him by Hoover and by, I guess, apparently later by FDR as well. He took the same position you did.
In 1942, it might have been desire for me to head up the War Production Board. Later in that summer, I believe it was the summer of 1942, FDR called me in the West, and I was in Oregon, and got me to agree to resign from the court and to head the War Production Board. And I reluctantly agreed to do that, and I came back and reported to the White House in September of that year, a few days after he'd talked me on the telephone, said I was ready to come down and to the White House and work out the details with the President, submit my resignation from the court. And I got no reply back that day. The next morning, I saw in the paper that Donald Nelson had been appointed head of the War Production Board. I think it was the War Production Board. And it turned out that I was greatly relieved of it because I had no desire to leave the court, certainly not for that kind of a job. I had been promoted, I found out later, for that by Baruch, Bernard Baruch, who at that time was rather close to me. A man who was very much opposed to me having the job, I heard later, was Harry Hopkins. And it was Harry Hopkins who had his way and relieved me from the embarrassment of resigning from the court to undertake such a relatively minor job.
Another matter right about the same time, according to a letter in the FDR papers, this one from Justice Black, and dated 25 June 1940, the Justice offered to resign to help the President in his third term campaign. Well, you had only been on the court a little over a year at this time, but I wonder if Black discussed this matter with you. If you knew about it at the time, or if you knew what FDR's reaction was. Black offered to resign to help the President in his third-term campaign against Wilkie.
I didn't know about it right at that time, although I heard about it later. it came to me in a, at that, and even when I heard about it, I didn't hear about it from Black. It came to me in a rather curious way. I left the city in June 1940, going west with a family to the mountains of Oregon. And I had no idea of getting implicated in any way into the Democratic National Convention. Some of my friends had been promoting me as a running mate with FDR in 1940. And remember, one of those men was Tommy Corcoran, Thomas G. Corcoran. And he was fairly close to FDR. These were friends, enthusiastic friends who were not acting with any authorization on my part, and I didn't really truly know that they were doing this. I had no connection with the convention. As I recall, I was way back in the mountains on a pack trip during the convention with a friend of mine, now deceased, James T. Donald, a lawyer from Baker, Oregon. I think the two of us were out on a couple-week pack trip, fishing trip in the high country of the Willow Mountain. The convention, I don't know. I never tried to find out. But Black's interest in, at that time, leaving the court, came to me when I got back from that summer recess, and the court reconvened, and the convention was over, and the campaign was on, and Roosevelt's running mate, I believe, was Wallace, Henry Wallace. Tommy Corcoran and others associated with him at some junction prior to the convention in 1940 had tried to get support for me, trying to get people to call FDR to put me in instead of Wallace. And one of the persons that they had approached was Hugo Black. And they told me in the fall what they had tried to do. And it was rather humorous. They were trying to get, among others, Black to call FDR. But Black didn't want to call FDR because Black was anxious to get into the campaign himself and be FDR's running mate. This all came to me in, I think it was September when I got back, 1940, which was a wholly new, interesting idea that I'd not been aware of up to that time.
Would have been an interesting ticket geographically balanced to New York and Alabama.
Yes. And you go back, Black would be a great campaigner.
Yeah. The next question. Oh, do you know what FDR's reaction was to this? Did he have any? Do you know of?
I never discussed anything with FDR about myself in relationship to any political office. He talked to me many times about leaving the court for this, that, and the other thing, but never about leaving the court to run with him.
I wonder if you know anything of the background of the appointments of Justices Harlan and Potter Stewart.
I don't know much about the appointment of Potter Stewart. I think the appointment of Harlan was due largely to the efforts of Harold Burton. Harold Burton thought that the name Harlan was an important one in constitutional history at this particular time, in view of the emergence of the racial problem and the increasing importance of the decisions in the field, minority rights, protection of Negroes, restrictive covenants, segregation, public parks, schools, railroads, and so on. And the symbol of equality and for the races centered pretty much around Harlan's descent, the first Justice Harlan's descent in Plessy versus Ferguson. Burton talked to me about it at the time, how wonderful it would be to get that, that name, which is a symbol of equality, on the court. What a political stroke it would be for a president to do that. And I think he carried the ball on it. I think that was the real reason. Now, there were other people also, but I think Harold Burton was largely responsible for that.
It's interesting, you probably know, that you probably noticed, to see the number of people who were close to Thomas Dewey, who worked for his law firm, who ended up as federal judges during the Eisenhower administration, either in New York. Of course, Harlan was had worked for Dewey at one point. I've forgotten whether either in his law firm or as one of his assistants when he was district attorney. Of course, Brownell, the attorney general, was an old Dewey man as well. This is a question on, specifically on your procedure. I wonder how you go about handling petitions for certiorari. That is, do you, as some justices are reported to do, have your clerk brief them, or do you go through all of this, the whole full step yourself?
I go through each petition myself, but I also have my law clerk write a digest or a summary, trying to get it on one sheet of paper, which does not always succeed, of the main issues presented, and an analysis of whether or not the issues, the constitutional or federal questions, are properly presented, and his recommendation whether to grant, to deny, to grant in reverse, to grant and vacate, or dismiss or affirm or whatnot. I go over them independently of him, and I very seldom make any written notes myself, except at times to make a written notation on the sheet that which his memo appears. And then, on the basis of my own reading of the petitions and briefs and the jurisdictional statements in case of appeals and his recommendation, I make up my mind how I'm going to vote. The law clerk's memo is a convenient thing to have because there are some months passed between the grant of a petition and the argument of the case, and sometimes in case of petitions for rehearing, the memos are very helpful to make clear that a point was completely missed that's important, or that the point that's up for rehearing was considered previously. The historical record of the law clerk's memo is very useful.
In our last meeting, you talked a bit about Justice Reed. Do you know why he retired? As I recall, the reason, the announced reason, was ill health, but he's done a considerable amount of work on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia.
I never could understand why Stanley Reed retired. He was in good health. He was not robust. He had suffered from high blood pressure, and he'd gone down to a clinic at Duke University. I forget the name of the doctor who ran it. This was years back. And he spent some weeks down there, perhaps 2 months, perhaps 3 months, and got on a rice diet. And this rice diet, three times a day, plus a little fruit, was a starvation diet that reduced the energy. And as all doctors know, a starvation diet of any kind, almost any kind, reduces blood pressure. And so Reed's blood pressure became very low. His energy became low. But he was still healthy. He was still active. He needed a lot of rest and sleep. But there was no reason why he should have retired. He never told me why he retired, except that he thought that since he had arrived at the time when he could retire, that he would just take things a little easier. So perhaps he did feel an inadequacy that didn't appear in his work. But he has been very, very active, not only in the Court of Appeals in the district, but also in the Court of Claims. And he's written many opinions, and I suppose actually the number of hours he has spent per day have been almost as great since he left the court as he spent before he left the court. That is, hours per day on the cases, writing of opinions, reading of records, briefs, and so on.
Under various statutes, the Supreme Court is allowed to make certain appointments of its own staff, a marshal, a clerk, a director of the administrative office of the U.S. courts, and several others. How do the justices go about deciding how these places shall be filled?
Well, when it comes to one's own staff, those are personal selections that are merely passed on to the Chief Justice, who approves them routinely if the appointment is within the budget that has been approved. As respects the officials of the court, the marshal, the clerk, the director of administrative office, those are appointments made by the court. But in practical effect, they are appointments made on the recommendation of the Chief Justice. The members of the conference have felt, since the Chief Justice is the administrative head of the court, he's the one that has in charge the building, the operation of the building, the janitors, the scrub women, the police. He's the one that sees more of the marshal and the clerk, and has more to do with the running of the machinery than any other member of the court. That he should have the effective say in the designation. So invariably, the recommendation of the Chief Justice for one of those offices has been followed by the conference.
Has this been the rule as long as you've been on the court?
Yes. It was under each of the four Chief Justices which I've served to date. Sometimes some Chief Justices were a little more informal about it than others. Stone treated it more like he would a item of business for the law school faculty when he was dean. Hughes, Vinson, and Warren speak with a little more exact
The next question is a long one. Perhaps I just, for the tape, will abbreviate it. A number of students of the court's work have been fascinated by the question of whether there is a pattern in the way a Chief Justice assigns opinion in the court, and if so, what this pattern means. I wonder if you might, or if you have found any kind of pattern under the various Chief Justices with whom you've sat.
Well, I think it's quite clear that none of them had the idea of assigning an opinion so as to have one man emerge as the spokesman in a particular field. I don't think that has been any conscious factor in assignment of cases. I think rather just the reverse has been true, that an effort has been made to keep any one man from being the spokesman for the court in a particular field. No specialization, in other words. The tendency of each Chief Justice I've served under has been to make the assignment, if possible, to the man who could get the greatest number of votes, to the man who comes closer than any other man to speaking for a consensus, for representing the consensus in the conference, as disclosed by a conference discussion. Hughes had a custom of never assigning an opinion to a man who already had an opinion that was unwritten. He made his assignments to those who had nothing to do. As a result, those who turned out work like Stone and Black and myself, we got more than each of us got more than the ninth of the load. And I think Stone continued that practice. And I think Vincent did. It was a thing that annoyed Frankfurter, because he would get an opinion or two assigned to him in October, and he would almost invariably keep that opinion until April or May. And finally there was a reporter, I forget his name, who worked for the Washington Post, who started running statistics on the volume of work that the judges did as measured by opinions for the court written by each judge. And at the end of the term, he would publish in the Washington Post the production of each justice, production in terms of opinions for the court. And some of us would run very high. Frankfurter would always be very low. Not because he was incapable of writing opinions. He could turn out opinions probably faster than anybody else. But he had his fingers in so many things. that the Post has ever had. But the when Warren came on as Chief Justice, he instituted a different system. He decided that every member of the court should pull the same size oar and row as hard as anybody else. And so he has roughly a lot of the opinions, one ninth to each judge, and he's tried to level it out so that if a judge gets a big, complicated case the next time around, he gets a simple case. He's tried to even out the workload. That has some advantages and disadvantages to those of us who get out our work promptly, because we have practically nothing to do from the 1st of May on. And judges who work more slowly are working long hours, Sundays, until the whole thing comes to a halt sometime near the end of June. The Hughes method was designed purely from the point of view of efficiency by the Hughes standards. And the Hughes standard was to spend as little time in conference as possible, to not exhaust yourself by analyzing cases, to leave most of the energies for writing opinions, assign the opinions according to the ability of the people to get the judges to get the opinions out. And Hughes was always aiming for recess of the court by the last Monday in May. He loved those long recesses. He enjoyed his months in the out west in the mountains, in some park with Mrs. Hughes. Those were the real highlights of his life in his later years. And I think that's why he worked it that way. He'd also had some experience with Vandevanner. Vandevanner, who was very able, one of the ablest men that ever sat on the court, had a rather unique disability. Once he picked up a pencil or a pen, he couldn't get his ideas running. If he sat back and talked orally,